The views, opinions, and content of the show hosts and their guests appearing on America's Web Radio are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of the station.
You're listening to America's Web Radio on the AmericasBroadcastNetwork.com. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to America's Web Radio. This is Ron Bachman. You're listening to Healthcare Insight. Today, I want to set aside a special time just to talk about Veterans and Veterans Day. I know we just had Veterans Day last week, November 11th, 2023, and it's a very special day that many people sort of pass by these days, don't pay a lot of attention to. There's not a lot of public celebration around Veterans Day. So I want to take the time now in this program to highlight Veterans Day, because I know that America's Web Radio and its owner, Dave Moxley, is a very strong supporter of veterans, Veterans Day. He himself is a veteran. I am a veteran. I served in the Coast Guard for 6 years, both active and reserve duty. And so I want to talk about the military and the reserves during this hour. In this first segment, I want to go back and talk about some of the experiences of those of my generation. I grew up and was, my generation was involved with Vietnam. Now, many of us think about the military and the wars that have gone on, and we think more about World War I and World War II as part of our history. And many of us tend to forget about the Vietnam War. It was not a very popular war, and so maybe that's why it gets pushed back into our consciousness a little bit. But those people were serving valiantly. Many died. Many were injured. But in the 1970s, unlike today, we did not have a volunteer military. It was a time of the draft that the military would come and say, it's your time to come and serve. It's your time to come and serve. And because the volunteer part of the service was not working very well, there was actually a lottery that was set up, because you were given a number based upon your birth date. And there were certain exceptions. For example, if you were a college student, you got an exemption for the time that you were in college, for a four-year exemption. And I was personally given a very low number. My older brother, Dick, was given an even lower number than I had. So there was no doubt that we were going to be drafted as soon as we finished school. So let me tell you a little bit about that time and that process. That my father had died, and my older brother, Dick, had graduated from Georgia Tech, and he had a low number, so he was expecting to be drafted. He was trying to find a way to stay home to support my mother, my widowed mother, and take care of the family, because that was another exemption. As they went through some of his records, strangely enough, there was a, because I think, suspect because there was so much anti-war activity going on, that the records that were being held for him in a government office up in Philadelphia actually burned. And so a lot of his background and records and draft notices and all that were burned in that building. But ultimately, he was going to get drafted. They were able to, you know, get together the information necessary to who was qualified to go and who was not, who had an exemption, who was not. So my brother actually discovered the Coast Guard. And the Coast Guard did not keep a reserve list, as many did. The National Guard, the each of the military branches usually kept a list of people that you could get into the reserve units and not have to serve in Vietnam, as honorable as that would be. And neither my brother nor myself signed up for any reserve list. We knew that whenever the time came and we were called upon, we would then serve after doing our college stint. Well, my brother found the Coast Guard Reserve, which had no list, but they opened up the Coast Guard recruiting process whenever the Congress allocated money. And in the spring of 1971, they allocated money and opened up the reserves. My brother actually got in and was headed off to boot camp for the Coast Guard up in Cape May, New Jersey. And as he was leaving, the recruiter knew about myself, the younger brother that was about a year or so behind in school. And at the time, he called me as my brother was leaving and said, do you want to go into the Coast Guard as well? And I said, well, I've got another quarter to go at Georgia Tech to finish up my degree, and then I would be glad to go. He said, well, we don't know if there's going to be funding to last that long, so you need to make a decision. And I said, well, I've got about two more weeks left in this quarter of school. Can I finish out the quarter of school? And he said, yes, you can do that. So I wound up going into the reserves a couple weeks behind my brother at boot camp and then serving together in the military for about another 6 years. Now, what happened was that we went to Cape May, New Jersey boot camp, and it was a fantastic experience. I think anybody who actually goes into the military, one of the more lasting impressions that you get is your time in boot camp. There's a lot of hardship, physical, mental hardship. There's a matter of getting discipline that you may not have had previously. You have people from all sorts of backgrounds and economic strata in the United States. So it's a way to come together and learn how to team appropriately and accept people for who they are as everybody is trying to learn the skills necessary to be an effective soldier or whatever your classification was going to be, whatever your job was going to be in the military, to get some basic background and learn the principles of hard work and discipline and dedication and teamwork. All those things are very valuable in the military, and I certainly learned them as well in the military. Now, I wanted to talk about some various things that come up after the military. I served in Atlanta doing recruiting for the military. I had jobs down in Jacksonville, Florida, checking on cargo of ships that were coming into the United States. Many times those were a delivery of cars that were dropped off in Jacksonville after having come through the Panama Canal from Japan. And so we would check cargo both coming and going out of those ships, be sure that the cargo manifests didn't include anything that was dangerous or illegal or whatever. Also served time over in Charleston, South Carolina, helping with the administrative work of that particular location. So the military can offer an individual an awful lot of different experiences, different locations, different people, different ways to serve in time, not just in combat, but in helping provide all the support services and other activities. The Coast Guard, to a large degree, it's probably one of its biggest jobs, and it was sort of touched on in the Jacksonville work I had, and that is illegal drugs that are coming across the oceans into the United States, specifically from South America, Cuba, and Central America countries that were trying to drop off cocaine, heroin, marijuana out in the oceans with high-speed boats, and the Coast Guard's job is to try to protect the coast there. My main active duty was up in Bar Harbor, Maine. Actually, it's in Southwest Harbor, Maine, was the actual location of the base, and we checked that area that was filled with lobster fishermen and other ocean harvesting boats of fish of various types. So we were there to sort of protect that area from any kind of illicit drugs that would come in or illegal activities that would happen during my time up there. So again, a great set of experiences in the reserves. You spend basically about 6 months in active duty and then 5.5 years in reserve duty. And during the 5.5 years, you spend several weeks a year going to these various locations to help out and support the Coast Guard where they assign you. Now, I live in Destin, Florida, and it's a very heavy military area. And, for example, there is the largest military base in the world, not just in the United States, but in the world, and of all the different services, Eglin Air Force Base basically owns about almost all or a very high percentage of the Northwest Florida panhandle area, as we call it. Now, there's also Tyndall Air Force Base that's in Panama City. There is, actually, most people may not even know this, but the Blue Angels, a lot of people are familiar with that. The air shows that they put on with the Air Force is actually located at the Naval Air Station. So they're really, the Navy is owned by and runs the Blue Angels. Those are naval pilots. But you also have the Coast Guard station in Panama, in Pensacola, Florida. The U.S. Army Rangers train down here because we have such a tropical area of swamps and areas that represent real challenges for training rangers. So Army Rangers are trained down here, and they have 2,000 or 3,000 service members here in a nearby city called Crestview. There's also the Air Force Special Operations that are here, again, because of this area is a great training ground. Now, one of the other things I would say about this area is that it's near the Gulf of Mexico. So for the Air Force, it's great. They actually can fly out over the ocean, so there's not a lot of general population at risk. And they actually do bombing runs and targeting out in the ocean. So as I live here in Destin, Florida, we can periodically hear the bombings that are going on out in the Gulf of Mexico. We hear a lot of the F-15, F-18, F-35 jets that are also flying. They're very loud, very noisy. And maybe in another setting, some other people might say, well, that's kind of annoying when you hear that. Quite honestly, what we in Destin typically call the sound of freedom. So we actually enjoy those loud noises that might come from the F-series jets that are going on. We also see a lot of Huey helicopters and other military flights going on constantly up and down the coast for training. And I think of moving certain cargo or transporting individuals from one location to another, because we have so many bases that are located all across this part of the Gulf of Mexico. So that's the core of what's going on down here and the military background. Now, what I want to do in the next segment is actually get into some of the history of our military services and the history of Veterans Day itself. But I wanted to sort of lay the foundation a little bit of the perspective that I have living right down here amongst the military bases, where so many of my friends and colleagues and my kids and grandkids are interacting with military veterans. It's a very patriotic area. It's a very polite area of yes, sir, and yes, ma'am. And the military background certainly helps to sort of create that camaraderie among the citizenry as many retired military stay in this area after they get out of the military. So stay with us for a quick commercial, and we'll be right back with a segment that gives you more background and information and details on Veterans Day itself.
Are you a veteran of Desert Shield or Desert Storm? We do a show for you every Monday at 1 p.m. on veteran-owned americaswebradio.com.
In 2009, the membership organization Docs for Patient Care was founded. People all around the country wanted to participate in the efforts of this group, and they wanted to join, but they were unable to do so unless they were physicians. It's for this reason that the Docs for Patient Care Foundation was created. Now, everyone can join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. While you're at your computer, please go to www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org, and make a tax-deductible donation and join the fight along with us. Thank you.
If you love classic cars, you're going to want to listen to the Classic Car Show with Tom Cox and Richard Lentinello on America's Web Radio. Live every Saturday at 9 a.m. Eastern at americaswebradio.com or on demand on your favorite podcast app.
You're listening to America's Web Radio on the americasbroadcastnetwork.com. Thank you for listening.
Welcome back to America's Web Radio. Today we're focusing on understanding Veterans Day. I'm Ron Bachman. I live in Destin, Florida, in the middle of a lot of military bases, Army, Navy, Coast Guard, Marines even down here. And I wanted to give you a flavor of what it's like to live in a military environment right outside the gates of all those bases, because it permeates the entire community, both people who are active duty, living outside, retired military that stay in this wonderful piece of paradise down here by the Gulf of Mexico with our wonderful beaches and fishing. And we do have tourism that can get crowded at times, but it's a wonderful area to live and raise a family as well because of that military influence. And let me give you a flavor before we go on to looking at the history of Veterans Day. Again, idea of living in a military type of a community. I have three grandchildren that go to school here, in elementary school, middle school, and getting ready to move into the high school area. But as an example, each year around Veterans Day, either on the exact Veterans Day or during the school week right following Veterans Day, they have a number of very patriotic programs, and I've been fortunate to be invited and to participate in programs most of these past years when I am in town and available. I love doing it. What it is a local elementary school that my grandkids have gone to, Butler Elementary School. They have this Veterans Day program. They bring in some of the active military to talk to the young children about the military. They raise flags, they sing songs, they play the music. And one of the more interesting parts that I enjoy and I'm able to participate in when they invite me is to go to the school and you sit in the back of a big auditorium. And one part of the program, sort of the major part of the program, a choir and the music director play each of the military songs, the theme songs, the fight songs, or whatever you want to call them. And as each is played, the Army, Navy, Marines, Air Force, Coast Guard, and now the Air Force or Space Force, those theme songs are played. And people who serve in those services will go down the middle aisle, and the kids are all high-fiving, waving American flags. And it's just a great joy. And I'm sure a memory that instills within these young children the value of the military, the excitement of the military, and a respect for the military. So that is what we do locally in a very patriotic, military-oriented community. Now, I want to spend some time in this segment getting into the history of the military. So I would like to talk about the beginnings of Veterans Day. How did it start? Why is it on November 11th? And what is the background and history of each of our services? So we all, in listening to this program, can learn something maybe new about the military, about Veterans Day itself, and why it is so important, how it got started and how it got founded, and how it actually changed its name from Armistice Day to Veterans Day. So there is a great a YouTube video that I'm going to call on, and I'm going to slice and dice it, and I'm going to explain to the audience and comment on several parts, maybe ask some questions of the presenter. So you may hear some music in the background. This is a video I wish everybody would watch in its entirety, but there's very few viewers of it on YouTube. But it's an important message that I think America's Web Radio is providing some support by being able to have me comment on it and present snippets out of it. The most important parts that I think give us a real background in the history and cut out certain segments so that we can focus in on the history and background of the Veterans Day and each of our services. So this program is presented by an organization called Drive Through History. They have multiple presentations. This one is on Veterans Day itself to give you a really good background in history, and the narrator is David Stotz. So let me ask David Stotz to give us a little bit of that background in history on Veterans Day itself.
In 1918, on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, an armistice was declared between Germany and the Allied forces, which effectively ended World War I. The following year, many countries celebrated November 11th as Armistice Day throughout the world. In the United States, President Woodrow Wilson declared November 11th, 1919, as the first national commemoration of Armistice Day. There were parades, picnics, and public speeches, as well as a moment of prayer in schools and businesses at 11 in the morning.
Notice two things in that bit of history. Certainly describes why we talk about November 11th. But from my standpoint, as I heard that, it brought back memories of my childhood and youth where we really celebrated as a country Veterans Day. Notice he also called it Armistice Day, and we're going to get to the transition from Armistice Day to Veterans Day. But the same thing happened in my youth where there was public display. We used to have parades. As a young child, I would take my bicycle and we would decorate it in red, white, and blue. We would put baseball cards on the spokes of the wheels so that there would be a noise, clickety-click noise. And we would march down with bands from the local schools down the main street. And at the end of the parade, we usually end up in a cemetery where people were putting out flags to those grave markers for veterans. So it was really a coming together of the community to recognize the importance of the military, the importance of Veterans Day. And it was a wonderful celebration that lingers in the memory as to why all this is so important, that people have given their lives for our freedoms. Now, let's ask David to explain how we sort of moved from Veterans Day, from Armistice Day to Veterans Day. When did that happen? The celebrations wound up being the same, but we changed the name and expanded the definition of what we were really celebrating. So, David, tell us about that.
In 1945, a World War II veteran from Birmingham, Alabama, had the idea to expand Armistice Day to celebrate all military veterans. Raymond Weeks led a delegation to Washington, D.C., urging then-General Dwight Eisenhower to create a national holiday that honored all veterans. In 1954, President Eisenhower signed legislation formally establishing November 11th as Veterans Day in America. Veterans Day is now a national holiday celebrating all the men and women who have served our great country in the U.S. military.
That segment there probably explains best why in my childhood, which was the late 50s, I know that's a long time ago, and early 60s, that we celebrated Veterans Day so fervently. It was a great holiday that brought everybody together, as I described, with picnics and marching bands and parades, because President Eisenhower was the general that led the victory in Europe. So he was a very revered president of the United States. And as a general, I think the whole idea of his declaring Veterans Day, and the fact that many of our fathers at the time had served in one capacity, either in the European campaign or in the Pacific campaign. So there was a lot of memories of people were trying to get back into civilian life from the issues that they maybe had to address in their military years. In the World War II and the Korean War is another one of those forgotten wars that many people were serving or had served in during my youth. So it was a very patriotic time of our country, and a recognition of the value of the military and what they did. So now let's go back to David again and have him try to explain what military forces we're talking about. How do we define military service and military forces in the United States? What does that really mean?
But what is the military? Well, in simple terms, the U.S. Armed Forces are made up of six branches: Army, Navy, Coast Guard, Marines, Air Force, and most recently, Space Force. Each branch of the military has a unique directive within the overall mission of U.S. security and peace.
Notice that David stopped with this drive-through history And just mentioned the Space Force. Well, that's a new segment of our military that was added under President Donald Trump. There's so much going on in the space environment where there are lots of countries with different satellites up there with different weapons that are probably going to be put into space. There needs to be treaties about how we treat each other's hardware that's up there. We're sharing space station activities with other countries around the world. So it's a whole new area with things like GPS and targeting and cameras that look down on the Earth from space. Is certainly critical for many of our logistics to be able to have those satellite connections, just like we do with our cars with GPS. A lot of things that run, a lot of the communications based upon specific and very sophisticated satellites that are in space, helping to guide those communications, helping to guide the military, trying to guide the communications and the review of our potential or actual enemies and what they're doing, what they're saying. So all that's very important. So let's take a few minutes here and begin a process of looking at the first of our services, the Army. So give us a little bit of background, and I know it'll carry over into the next segment, but tell us a little bit more about the military and background and history, especially the Army.
Let's start with the Army, the oldest branch of the U.S. military. When the American Revolution started at the battles of Lexington and Concord in April of 1775, the colonists didn't have an army. At that point in history, each of the 13 states relied on their own militias, made up of part-time civilian soldiers. But on June 14, 1775, the Second Continental Congress unified the colonial militias to fight the British forces by establishing the Continental Army. Almost immediately, the Continental Army absorbed 22,000 militia troops around Boston and 5,000 militia troops around New York City. It also established the first 10 companies of Continental Riflemen from Pennsylvania, Maryland, Delaware, and Virginia, which became known as the 1st Continental Regiment.
So there you have it, the very beginnings of the Army branch of our military. Many of us just think of the Army as being, you know, jeeps and tanks and more modern day World War II, maybe even World War I visions of the Army. But it actually began back in the Continental Congress and the colonial militia that were pulled together to create a national army under General George Washington. So let's take a quick break again, and we're going to come back and we're going to learn more about the Army and about the other services as we proceed to understand the history and background and the value of Veterans Day.
Veteran-owned, America's Web Radio would like to thank all of our incredible patrons. We wouldn't be able to do this without you. If you are not already a patron, you can help us continue to produce some of the most informative and entertaining shows on the internet by becoming a patron. Patrons of America's Web Radio are the first to receive information about new shows and links to the latest podcast episodes. Join now and receive a free gift while supplies last. For more information and to join our family, please visit www.patreon.com/America's Web Radio. If you have questions, contact us at gm@America'sWebRadio.com. And as always, thank you for listening.
Hey folks, this is Victor with the On Point with Victor show. Make sure you listen every Tuesday 1 to 2 only right here on America's Web Radio, the On Point with Victor show. Remember folks, I'm not angry, I'm just right. And you can find out why every Tuesday from 1 to 2, the On Point with Victor show only right here on America's Web Radio.
In 2009, the membership organization Docs for Patient Care was founded. People all around the country wanted to participate in the efforts of this group, and they wanted to join, but they were unable to do so unless they were physicians. It's for this reason that the Docs for Patient Care Foundation was created. Now, everyone can join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. While you're at your computer, please go to www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org and make a tax-deductible donation and join the fight along with us. Thank you.
You're listening to America's Web Radio on the AmericasBroadcastNetwork.com. Thank you for listening.
Welcome back to America's Web Radio. Today we are focusing on Veterans Day, the background and history of Veterans Day, and an identification of a little bit of the history of each of the armed forces. So far, we've talked about the beginnings of the Army and how it started off really from the Continental Congress. Now, most of us, just to wrap up the Army side, most of us think about West Point as the Army college, the training area where the officers come from. And all that's true, but it had some different names and different purposes historically. And I think it's worth spending a few seconds on that. So if David Stott would give us a little bit more background on West Point itself and why it was established and what it was established for and who established it, that would be great background information for our audience.
During some of the Revolutionary War, West Point was known as Fort Arnold, after its commander at the time, Benedict Arnold. But after his treasonous activities were uncovered in 1780, Arnold fled to the British side, and West Point was renamed Fort Clinton. Though the fort was used for training cadets in engineering, starting as early as 1794, it wasn't until 1802 that President Thomas Jefferson officially established the United States Military Academy here at West Point. It was the first military school in our new nation.
So Thomas Jefferson founded the original Army Military Academy at West Point. But there's a deeper perspective that I don't think most people understand. I certainly didn't understand. I think it'd be fascinating for our audience to understand that he didn't found it for military purposes directly. He had more of an interest in his more recent purchase that most of us know from history of the Louisiana Purchase and how this country was going to expand and grow westward and be able to utilize the land that he had bought from the French. So tell us a little bit more about that history of Thomas Jefferson.
Because when Jefferson founded the academy, he opposed large standing armies. He didn't want a large standing army. He preferred the militia. But what he did want was school-trained engineers, because as he bought the Louisiana Purchase and hoped to expand the country westward, he wanted school-trained engineers to build bridges, survey roads, and do all those things that a young nation needed. And the best place to get those engineers was at a military academy, and that's why he did it.
Now, Dave, in order to sort of wrap up this section on the Army, tell us a little bit about the size of the Army, where it is today, and give us a description of the size and extent of the Army branch of the military.
Today, the U.S. Army is made up of more than 700,000 soldiers, including active duty and Army Reserve personnel. I pray that God will continue to empower and protect these great men and women as we roll ahead into a new era of challenges at home and abroad.
Okay, let's move on to another branch of the military. Let's talk about the Navy and some of its origins, because most of us don't really get any education or any history around the military development of our U.S. Navy. So tell us a little bit about that.
Now, to explore the next branch of the U.S. military, the Navy, about 60 miles south of West Point, down the Hudson River, is the epic Manhattan Island. The U.S. Navy recognizes October 13, 1775, as the date of its formation. This is when George Washington encouraged Congress to officially create a Continental Navy and purchase two boats for missions against British merchant ships, bringing arms and supplies to the colonies. Then, 2 months later, Congress went on to authorize the construction of 13 warships armed with cannons. After the Revolutionary War ended, the Continental Navy was shut down and the remaining ships were sold off. the upstart United States was struggling financially, and Congress didn't see the need to maintain a naval force. The problem was that American merchant shipping had been protected by the British Navy. So, after the War for Independence, the United States no longer had any protection for its ships from the world's pirates. This was a big issue for merchant vessels operating in the Atlantic Ocean and Mediterranean Sea.
Well, Dave, since we know there is an actual U.S. Navy branch of the service, there must have been something that happened somewhere along the way that helped us to reestablish the Navy that was installed during the Revolutionary War. And then, as you say, all the assets were sold off. So what happened and how did we wind up protecting our merchant ships in the Atlantic and in the Mediterranean?
The issue came to a head in 1793 when Barbary pirates captured 11 American merchant ships and more than 100 sailors. This forced a big ransom payment by the United States. In response, Congress approved the Naval Act of 1794, which authorized the construction of 6 armed frigates. 3 of those ships, the USS United States, USS Constellation, and USS Constitution, were completed and launched 3 years later to help deal with the growing crisis. The Constitution, probably the most famous of the ships, was nicknamed Old Ironsides and can still be visited today in Boston Harbor.
Dave, after building these warships, did the piracy continue, and what might have happened subsequent to that to try to stop the Barbary Coast pirates from taking U.S. property and ships and killing any of our crew?
In 1801, Tripoli began to increase its piracy campaigns. This time, the United States was ready. President Thomas Jefferson ordered U.S. Navy vessels to the Mediterranean Sea, and the First Barbary War began. After a couple of years of small sea battles, the Navy started hitting the pirate harbors along the North African coast.
Okay, Dave, I think we're there, where this history is going, which I recall a little bit from some of my background. Maybe other people don't remember this, but many people will remember the Marine theme song, which says, from the shore, from the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli. And I think that's where this is coming in, the Navy and the Marines sort of coming together, and maybe the establishment of this additional armed services specialty area of the Marines. Is that correct? It seems like there's a good tie-in here that I think is fascinating to me, and I think will be insightful to our audience.
Then, in April of 1805, the U.S. captured the port city of Derna in a daring raid, which also included U.S. expeditionary forces known as the Marines. Supported by the heavy guns of the USS Argus, USS Hornet, and USS Nautilus, American forces captured Derna, deposed the leader of Tripoli, and won the First Barbary War. At increasing piracy attacks, and the Second Barbary War broke out. This time, the U.S. Navy quickly defeated the Algerian fleet and secured a lasting end to the Barbary practice of piracy, tribute, and ransom on the high seas. Although the Navy didn't see much action in World War I, it came into its own during World War II and in the period since then.
Well, Dave, the Navy has certainly evolved from those very humble beginnings that you described and the ultimate need to protect our merchant fleets around the world. Where do we stand today, and how do you stack up where our Navy is today? And I know you've described before in other settings how it's more from putting cannons on a ship to having battleships, which much larger guns, to having aircraft carriers carrying the planes and our Air Force during World War II and beyond, and to Vietnam and Korea and other ways that we have utilized the Navy. So tell us where we are today in terms of our comparison across the world to other navies.
Today, the U.S. Navy is the largest, most advanced ocean-going armed force on the planet. It leads the world in technology, including the fields of propulsion, surveillance, and weaponry. The modern Navy is a beacon of strength and resolve on the high seas, with a 21st century mission of maintaining security and deterrence through a sustained forward presence throughout the globe. The size and influence of our Navy around the world continues to amaze me. I pray that our country continues to fully support the far-reaching mission of these awesome men and women.
Okay, Dave, now comes what may be my most favorite segment, and that is about the service that I was in, the Coast Guard. Most people don't know a lot about the Coast Guard. They're not as high profile. They're not as large by any means as any of the other services. But the Coast Guard does play a unique role, and it has a unique history. So give us a little bit of that, and then we'll talk about some of the activities that are special to the Coast Guard and the type of protections and safety that it provides for Americans and business and our interests around the world. So give us a little bit of the history of the Coast Guard.
The Coast Guard was initially known as the Revenue Cutter Service, one of the oldest organizations in our federal government. It was established on August 4th, 1790, when President George Washington signed the Tariff Act, authorizing the construction of 10 armed vessels, known as cutters, to enforce trade laws and prevent smuggling. Until Congress established the Navy Department 8 years later, in 1798, the Coast Guard served as the nation's only armed force on the water.
Wow, that's interesting. I didn't even know all those details about its naming of the Revenue Cutter Service. So take us to the next step. How did it get to become called the Coast Guard?
In 1915, the Revenue Cutter Service merged with the U.S. Life-Saving Service and was officially renamed the Coast Guard. It became the only U.S. armed service dedicated to saving life at sea and enforcing the nation's maritime laws. In 1939, the Coast Guard absorbed the Lighthouse Service, and in 1946, all merchant marine licensing and vessel safety responsibilities. Today, the Coast Guard is both a federal law enforcement agency and a military force, and therefore is a faithful protector of the United States in peacetime and war. In times of war, or at the direction of the president, the Coast Guard serves under the Department of the Navy, defending the nation against foreign threats and terrorism. In times of peace, the Coast Guard operates as part of the Department of Homeland Security, enforcing the nation's laws at sea, protecting the marine environment, guarding the nation's vast coastline and ports, and performing vital life-saving missions.
Let's take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back to finish up the story of my favorite service, the one I served in, the Coast Guard, and then we'll finish up the history in the next segment, the final segment of this hour. We'll finish up the history of Veterans Day and the U.S. military's involvement and development and the history of how we got to where we are with so many great military services. I salute each and every one of you that may be listening to this who have served and those who want to serve and those who are looking forward to future service. Veterans, we salute you. Let's take a quick commercial break and we'll be right back.
The Docs for Patient Care Foundation is your way to join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. Get a pen and paper. Write down www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docsforpatientcarefoundation.org. Go to our site and please make a generous tax-deductible donation and join the fight today. Thank you.
Are you a veteran of Desert Shield or Desert Storm? We do a show for you every Monday at 1 p.m. on veteran-owned americaswebradio.com.
If you love classic cars, you're going to want to listen to the Classic Car Show with Tom Cox and Richard Lentinello on America's Web Radio. Live every Saturday at 9 a.m. Eastern at americaswebradio.com or on demand on your favorite podcast app.
You're listening to America's Web Radio on the AmericasBroadcastNetwork.com. Thank you for listening.
Welcome back to the final segment of today's Healthcare Insight, where we are focusing on Veterans Day and the military services, a little bit of the history and background. There's so much more than we could ever present in these short segments. But for those of you who have been listening, to those of you who really are involved with the military, we salute you. And I want to go back and finish up my very favorite armed services, and that is the Coast Guard, where I served for 6 years. So let's go back to Dave and have him give us a little bit of a wrap-up on where the Coast Guard is today. And, I mean, it's only, I think, 56,000 members compared to hundreds of thousands of members in the Army and others, but yet the mission for the Coast Guard is very widespread over much of this country, both on the oceans and in the inland waterways, rivers, lakes. Wherever you have water and you have people in need, you're probably going to find the Coast Guard or a civilian part of that called the Coast Guard Auxiliary, which is not directly a part of the Coast Guard, but you get the message that if Coast Guard Auxiliary is there on a lake and you have trouble, they're going to be coming to help you. So the motto of Semper Paratus of the Coast Guard is always ready, and that's what the Coast Guard was during my time with the Coast Guard. And I hope any of you who ever have any level of distress, you will find the Coast Guard ready to help you at any point in time. So, Dave, give us a little bit of a wrap-up on the Coast Guard.
Today, there are over 56,000 members of the U.S. Coast Guard operating a multi-mission fleet of approximately 2,000 crafts. This includes about 240 of their famous cutters and 200 fixed and rotary wing aircraft. The Coast Guard protects and defends more than 100,000 miles of U.S. coastland and inland waterways. The service also patrols an exclusive economic zone, or EEZ, covering 4.5 million square miles, stretching from north of the Arctic Circle to south of the equator, and from Puerto Rico to Guam. In addition to its role as a branch of the armed services, the Coast Guard is a first responder and a humanitarian service that provides aid to people in distress or impacted by disasters. The Coast Guard's motto is Semper Paratus, always ready. Wow. The unsung heroes of the U.S. Coast Guard. What an incredible legacy of service here and around the world.
As we get ready to now move on and talk about the United States Marine Corps, let me just interject this little comment that in the last presentation, the current state of the Coast Guard is to report under the Navy in times of war. Interestingly enough, when I was in the Coast Guard during the Vietnam War, anybody who wanted to go into combat from the Coast Guard would be transferred over to the Marines. So that was kind of an interesting change in where we were when I was in the Coast Guard and where we are today. But let me present this next segment on the Marines. Now, it's a segment that I clipped off of a YouTube video, and it has music in the background of the Marine Corps song. But I think the words and description of what the Marine Corps is all about is so apt that I wanted to include this. If you listen to the history and the background of the Marine Corps, I think you'll find it very interesting.
The history of the U.S. Marine Corps goes all the way back to the beginning of the United States. First established as the Continental Marines in 1775 to conduct ship-to-ship fighting during the American Revolution, the Marines have served in almost every U.S. conflict since. For nearly 2.5 centuries, the Marines have developed a worldwide reputation in amphibious warfare and earned widespread respect for rapid response and fierce fighting.
You know, most of us know the Marines, if at all, by the image of the raising of the flag on Iwo Jima. I mean, it's a great picture. It was a Pulitzer Prize-winning picture made to symbolize
the American Armed Forces and the Marines in particular raising that flag on Iwo Jima. And what I want to do to wrap this up, this segment, is a little personal story of my experience with the Marines when I was recruiting in Atlanta, Georgia, for the Coast Guard. I recall one day, for example, that the offices were closed down. For some reason, the building manager didn't open up the individual offices. And we were all there recruiting, Army, Navy, Marines, Air Force. We were all doing recruiting activities. And we were all standing in the hallway there waiting for somebody to come to open up the doors. Now, these were old-fashioned building structures with a what's called a transom above. It's like a glass window above that sort of opens and closes in these older buildings to let summer heat out, if you will. And so those were flexible. They weren't fixed windows. And so we were all kind of standing around there. And then the Marine recruiters came in, and the Marines were always the most buff of the entire armed services personnel that were in the offices. They were very nice, polite, but they were strong as you can ever imagine, and representing the Marines to the utmost in their physical capabilities. Well, the Marines came in that day when we were all standing in the door waiting for somebody to allow us into the offices. When the Marines came in, looked at their office, looked up, saw that transom that was slightly cracked, well, in a second, one of them had leaped up about 8-9 feet and went through that transom and opened the door from the other side. It was truly an amazing experience, but you know that the Marines are capable of doing almost anything with their physical capabilities. They're smart people. They know what to do. They know their job, but boy, their physical capabilities are probably beyond almost anything but special forces in the other services. So let's do a wrap up on the Marines here. Dave, tell us a little bit more about it as we wrap up this segment on the United States Marine Corps.
The U.S. Marine Corps, the few, the proud, indeed. Such a legacy of true, courageous warriors that have dutifully served our country for generations.
Okay, Dave, I live in the land down here of Florida, with military Air Force bases all around and a lot of retired military. So let's talk about the Air Force next. Give us a little bit of the background and the history of how the Air Force got started and where it is today.
The United States Air Force became a separate military branch after World War II with the passage of the National Security Act of 1947. The act established the U.S. Department of Defense, initially comprised of the Army, Navy, Marines, and newly created Air Force. Prior to 1947, military aviation had a proud history, divided among the Army for land-based operations and the Navy and Marine Corps for sea-based operations. By the 1950s and 60s, air power became a major pillar of America's national defense. U.S. air superiority has been the key to U.S. military success since World War II. Thanks to all our members of the United States Air Force for controlling the skies.
You know, as you've described, Dave, the Air Force capabilities after World War II has become so important for worldwide peace and attacking issues that are very specific to places around the world where we can project our Air Force and the power that comes with it. Yes, it has a good history going back to the beginnings of air flight from Orville and Wilbur Wright, but the military use is more recent. But now we've actually gone beyond the normal airspace around the country and around the globe to another area. Tell us about the newest Air Force version that is needed and is required a separate department in the Department of Defense.
Military control of the airspace has been an increasing challenge in recent years since the world now competes in the region beyond our skies, outside our atmosphere. Over the last few decades, the launch, command, and control of satellites has become crucial to our military operations and national defense. Satellites provide essential support to our military forces, secure communications, weather and navigational data, and threat warnings. Due to this 21st century reality, we just got a new branch of the U.S. military, Space Force. The U.S. Space Force was approved as the latest branch in the American Armed Forces in December of 2019. Since then, they have been recruiting a team of military and civilian personnel to enhance the competitive edge of our Department of Defense.
Well, Dave Strutt, and the drive-through history channel that you put together this information on is truly remarkable, and I hope our audience has enjoyed sort of this quick trip through the ages to understand each of the military services, and in particularly to understand why we are so focused today on this program of recognizing Veterans Day and the importance of it. Would you sort of wrap us up a little bit, Dave, with telling us about Veterans Day in particular and your thoughts relative to that very special day that we are celebrating?
While Veterans Day focuses on those who have previously served in our military, many of us treat the holiday a bit more inclusively. In addition to our past service members, there are also active duty soldiers and sailors, our reserve and National Guard forces, and of course, the millions of family members who have served our country by supporting their military spouses, parents, and children over the years. To all of you, thank you for your service.
Well, Dave, thank you for the service of giving us all this background and history that everybody out there listening should pay close attention to and reflect on the wonders of this country, the freedoms that we enjoy. And the basis of that freedom is that people are willing to die for it. And we have military services that have done that over 250 years or more. So give us some final thoughts and wrap this program up, if you would, please, on the military in general.
You know, I shudder to think about a United States of America without its military, diligently standing guard. Human nature has fallen. Bad actors seek power, and history tends to repeat itself. Therefore, an American policy of peace through strength should be as true today as it's ever been. We need to maintain our national willingness to engage evil when it rears its ugly head. We need to cherish our warrior class, those willing to take the fight overseas to defend our liberty at home. And we need to stand resolved in our military alliances with other nations that still promote the causes of freedom, democracy, and morality around the world. On this Veterans Day in America, I celebrate our nation's military history and sincerely honor the service and sacrifice of our military members and their families. On behalf of myself and the Drive Through History team, thank you again for your service.
And thank you to this wonderful audience and America's Web Radio for its support of veterans and its programming around veterans' interests and needs as retirees, as actives. Please join us again next week as we talk about other political issues. But remember, Veterans Day is one day in the year just to bring it forward in our minds, but thank the veterans every day of every year for their service that gives you the freedoms and liberties that you and I both enjoy. Join us again next week. Have a good week.
The views, opinions, and content of the show hosts and their guests appearing on America's Web Radio are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of the station.
You're listening to America's Web Radio on the AmericasBroadcastNetwork.com. Thank you for listening.